If you will, take your New Testament and turn to Luke chapter 1. I began a study last week of the Gospel of Luke, but I want to introduce the study by a story from Mark chapter 9. Christ, Peter, James, and John have gone up on a mountain, and Christ has been transfigured. And when they come down, there is a commotion involving the other nine disciples. There was a father who brought his son, who had been demonized for a long time, asking the disciples to help, and they failed to cast out the demon. Christ had given them the power to do this, but they simply failed to do it. And there was a big to-do about this, and Christ stepped in. And in verses 22 through 24 of Mark chapter 9, the father's explaining to Christ about his son, that often the demon has thrown his son into the fire, into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, what I've read is that the King James and the New King James do not quite translate correctly what Christ said in verse 23. The New International Version does. What Christ is doing in verse 23 is repeating to the man what the man just said to him. The man said to him, if you can. And Christ in reply says, if you can, implying, of course I can. The real issue is whether you believe all things are possible. I can because all things are possible to him who believes. And then is made the statement that I think is one of the most honest statements found in Scripture. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Now here's faith looking for a footing. Here's faith that's been knocked off its feet by the failure of Christ's disciples, and that's the way it often happens in this world. It's not Christ people react to. It's the failure of Christians to be Christ-like that people react to. And this man's trying to hold together his sanity. And he says, I believe, help thou my unbelief. And the fact of the matter is, we often find ourselves in that situation. McLaren said that men don't differ in the depths, they differ on the surface. And what he meant by that is, I've never had a demonized child. I've had a child, children that I've worried sleepless over, children I've worried sick over, children I've probably been distraught about, just like this father was distraught about his son. We don't doubt the deep verities of our faith. It's things that happen in life that we don't think should happen, or things don't happen that we think should happen, that causes us problems. And I'd like to say a few things tonight from Luke chapter 1 about this matter of being an unbelieving believer, because we have a wonderful illustration of that in Luke chapter 1. And if you've got your Bible open to Luke 1, let me point out a few things about this gospel. Luke was a physician. He was a doctor. Paul tells us that in Colossians 4. To tell us that he was a doctor means that he was a scientist. That's what a doctor is. A scientist is someone who looks at things and then test those things, experiments with those things to try to understand what those things are all about, and then he tells us what he has found out. When a doctor says, stick out your tongue, he's going to look. He might take a swab to have Carl run through his test. That's what Carl used to do for me and my family. And based upon the testing and the observing, he might say, you've got strep throat. Now, that's all that a scientist is. And in the first four verses of Luke 1, Luke's scientific training and background are readily apparent. He's writing to a fellow who apparently was a member of the Equestrian Order. The Equestrian Order was right below the Praetorian Order in Roman society. Theophilus, to say he's a member of the Equestrian Order is to say that he is a knight. Now, in England, they called their knights Sir Galahad, Sir Lancelot, but in Rome, their knights were called Most Excellent. And so he's writing to this man, And he's talking about things that Theophilus had been told. And he talks about how he had been involved in researching the things that they had heard, talking to eyewitnesses, talking to those who were ministers of the word, seeking perfect understanding. Now, that's science talk. I mean, that's how a scientist talks. He is seeking perfect understanding of some matter before him. And having arrived at perfect understanding, he is telling Theophilus, now here's what I found. And so in the first four verses, we are made to understand that Luke is the scientific gospel. I mean, that's important to know in a world that has a deified science. In our secular society, our seculars worship in the temple of science, and scientists are the priests, and anything they say goes, no matter what they say, how it may be contrary to what Scripture has to say. So here's a scientist taking a scientific approach to Jesus of Nazareth. And wouldn't you know it, in the first verse following the introduction, verse 5, he says exactly the kinds of things a scientist would say, an historian would say, following his investigation. There are seven facts with which Luke begins his account of the life of Christ. And seven, of course, is the perfect number. And Luke and the Gospels in various places call our attention to the number seven. But look at verse 5 of Luke 1. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron. Her name was Elizabeth. He first of all sets the time frame. In the days of Herod, king of Judea, that could only be one man. Herod the Great. Only he was accorded by Rome the title King of Judea. His son Aristarchus, who succeeded him, was named the Ethnarch of Judea. So Luke nails down the time frame. He tells us about a man who was a priest. We know the man's profession. We know his name, Zechariah. We know that he was of the order of Abijah in the time of David. David divided the priest into 24 orders or courses, and they would rotate ministering in Jerusalem at the temple. Levitical priests, on average, ministered in the temple 1 month out of every 2 years. 23 out of 24 months, they were back home teaching, being involved with the people. But as they rotated, about 2 weeks out of every year, 4 weeks out of every 2 years, they'd be up in Jerusalem functioning there in the temple. And so we know his order. We know he was married. We know his wife was also a Levite of the daughters of Aaron. We know his wife's name. So this doctor, scientist, who takes a scientific approach to the gospel, packs the very first verse with information that could be checked out by anyone who wanted to check it out. Now, that's not what you do when you're writing mythology. When you're writing a fictional story, you are as generic. You don't say in the days of Herod, the king of Judea. You say once upon a time. And so verse 5 bears all the stamp of the kind of scientific reporting we would expect from someone like Luke. Now, let me tell you the story. You can read the story in verses 5 through 25, but I'll tell you the story. After 400 years, God is going to again speak to man. He's going to give revelation to man. And he picks up right where he left off. In the last two verses of the Old Testament, Malachi 4, 5, and 6, God says Elijah's coming back. In the first thing he says to any man after 400 years, he says, I've got some more information about this Elijah. And he's going to tell Zacharias that he and his wife, who were righteous people, not because they were sinless people, because God's gracious. That's why they were righteous. God counted them righteous. They walked in the commandments and ordinances of God. They didn't have any child. Elizabeth was barren. They were both well advanced in years. And an angel comes to tell Zechariah that they're going to have a boy. Now, this encounter happened when Zechariah was in the temple, when a priestly division was in Jerusalem for their stint there in the temple. they would cast lots, and involving the altar of incense, they would pick three priests. One priest would gather some coals from the altar and carry them in and lay them on the altar of incense. A second priest would go in with the incense and put the incense on the altar. And then the third priest would go in. The two who preceded him would come out. The third priest would go in to offer the prayers in connection with the incense being burned and the aroma going up to heaven. Now, they did this twice a day. That's what the law requires. They did it at 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. And those hours are significant. Christ was put on the cross at 9 a.m. and he stayed on the cross till 3 p.m. And so the offering of incense in its typical foreshadowing had ramifications even involving the death of Christ. And so I don't know if this is the morning or the afternoon sacrifice offering of incense, but Zechariah is there and suddenly he's startled because he realizes he's not alone and there's an angel there. We'd been startled too. And the first thing that God through the angel says after 400 years is, don't be afraid. And he proceeds to say that your prayer has been heard. Zechariah and Elizabeth have been praying for a son and or praying for a child. And the angel says, you're going to have a son. His name will be John. God is gracious. And he will be a prophet like Elijah was a prophet. And the angel tells Zechariah about the work that his son will be involved in. And when Zechariah gets a chance to speak in verse 18, he says, how shall I know this? For I am an old man and my wife well advanced in years. Now, sometime read all of Luke 1 and notice the parallel between Zechariah and Mary. An angel comes to both of them. Zechariah is an old man, Mary's a young girl. Zechariah's a priest, one skilled in the law. We don't know for sure how much Mary knew at the time of this, but an angel comes to both of them. An angel tells both of them, you're going to have a child. The birth of the child in both cases would be miraculous. I mean, that's the protest that Zechariah made. Considering my age, my wife's age, how can we have a child? Mary asked the question when she's told about this, well, how can this be, verse 34, since I do not know a man? And the answer is given, with God's nothing impossible. And both of them are going to have a son. The angel, not to Mary, but to Joseph, and here to Zechariah, tells the name of the boy. The name is heaven given in both cases. And while not stated, both of these boys would die a violent death, die a terrible death. And so a lot of similarities between them, but Zechariah's question, how can this be, is very much different from Mary's question, how can this be? Because look at verse 19 at how the angel responds. Zechariah asked, how shall I know this? For I'm an old man, my wife well advanced in years. And the angel answered and said, I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, was sent to speak to you and bring you these glad tidings. Zechariah, do you think I came all the way here from heaven to tell you something that wasn't so? You want to know how you can know this? I'll tell you how you can know it. I'm Gabriel. I know what I'm talking about. And if you need further proof, you're not going to talk for the next 9 months. You're going to be mute. And the reason is because you did not believe my words. Verse 20. Here's a righteous man walking in the ordinances and commandments of the Lord. Gabriel said, you don't believe me. And we often find ourselves in similar situations where God says something to us about our circumstances, and we just don't believe Him. Now, I'm not talking about doubt like Gideon professed. I'm not talking about perplexity like Habakkuk had. I'm not talking about what Christ dealt with in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, Christ dealt with some perplexity there. He dealt with some bewilderment there. I want you to turn to Hebrews chapter 5. I want to show you something that I've been looking at that has helped me better understand what Christ was dealing with there in Gethsemane. When he prayed, "Father, let this cup pass," three times, "Father, let this cup pass, let this hour pass, don't make me go through it." In verses 7, 8, and 9 of Hebrews 5, there are three statements that Jesus makes implicitly, not explicitly. There are three things Jesus says in those three verses that have impressed me of late. Here's what they are. In verse 7, Jesus said, "I'm not going to cry." In verse 8, he says, "I don't know everything." In verse 9, he says, "I'm not perfect." Now, that may sound all like blasphemy to you, but I don't think it is. I think that's the import of these verses. Read with me verses 7 through 9. "Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him." Now, what the author is doing in these three verses is trying to impress upon us Christ's compassion, how it is that he is a compassionate high priest, how it is he understands what we're dealing with, what we go through. And the first thing he says in verse 7 is that Christ said, "I'm not going to cry." Now, the writer of Hebrews is the only one who tells us that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ cried, not simply cried. Strong crying. You know what that word in the Greek indicates? Strong. It indicates crying against your desire. Have you ever seen a sopping wet towel and you hold it up and it's holding all the water and you give it this? You wring it a little bit and the water comes pouring out. Have you ever told yourself, "I'm not going to cry"? You're dealing with some emotional situation, some heartbreaking situation, and you tell yourself, "I'm not going to cry." And then something happened, and it's just this. And before you know it, you're bawling with strong crying. I think the pain Christ encountered in Gethsemane was so much worse than maybe he even anticipated that he cried. You know, a week before Gethsemane, Christ said, "I'm not going to ask what he then asked for in Gethsemane." Did you know that? In John chapter 12, Christ says, "My hour's come, and what should I say? Father, save me from this hour." No, I'm not going to ask God that. That's why I'm here. I came for this hour. And a few days later, when the hour comes, what does Christ ask? "Save me from this hour." I mean, he's just like us. Tempted in all points, like as we. Tasted all of the emotions that we have to deal with. And here's the situation where he tells himself going in, "I'm not going to cry." But under the burden, it was just wrung out of him. And then the second statement there in verse 8, he says, "I don't know everything." Now, how can that be since he was God and omniscient? Chesterton said that Christianity is the only religion that dares suggest that omnipotence in some way made God incomplete. Now, I don't understand all of that. I don't understand how omnipotent deity did not know what Christ had to learn. But Christ had to learn something. And he learned it by his suffering. And in Hebrews, the suffering refers to his passion, his death. Look at Hebrews 2:9 to see that. But Christ in his passion, in his suffering, in his dying, learned what it means to be obedient when you don't feel like being obedient, when you're hurting, when you've just been laid out raw and unprotected and having to take all the pain that the devil can throw at you. And then in verse 9, Christ says, I'm not perfect, because he was made perfect. He was made perfect by his suffering, by his dying. Now, how was it that Christ was perfected in all of this? Well, I think he was perfected in that he, in fully drinking the dregs of the cup that was handed him and taking all of the wrath of God, understands like no one understands what we're going through in this life, what we have to deal with. But I think most importantly, Christ was perfected in regard to being a sacrifice. Wasn't he? I mean, when does a paschal lamb become a perfect sacrifice? When it's running around without spot and blemish and out there in the meadow, when does a paschal lamb become perfected? When its throat's cut and its blood's poured out and the blood is put upon the altar. That's when. And Christ in his dying became that perfect sacrifice that we needed. And all of that threw Christ for a loop. I mean, in the garden, he tells his disciples that he sensed even then, I don't know if he felt shock setting in or just what was going on. He talked about how his soul was near death, even there. And so there are times when we're perplexed. There are times when we have doubts because we can't connect the dots. But I think Zacharias went beyond that. Because the angel says, because you didn't believe me. We don't have any problem believing things that we have control over. We don't have problem believing things that we can see how nature can work to make something happen. We don't have problems seeing a problem that we know how to fix. It's when we run up against something that is completely out of our control, completely beyond our power, like having a child when you can't have a child anymore because, like Abraham and Sarah, your procreative powers are dead. And then being told you're going to have a child. That's when it's really a problem. I mean, had Zechariah never read the story of Abraham and Sarah? Had he never taught that before? I would have to think he knew about that story. But when he's told something similar is going to occur with you, he didn't hope against hope like Abraham did. In his heart, and Gabriel called him on it, you don't believe me, do you, Zechariah? Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Let me make two or three applications from this. And the first is that we're constantly challenged, I think, in regard to taking God at his word and believing him. Now, let me show you something here from the Gospel of Luke. Turn to Luke 24. There are a number of ways that Luke ends the way it starts. Luke begins with Zechariah in the temple. Luke ends with the disciples returning following the ascension to the temple and praising God, glorifying God. But I want you to look here beginning with verse 19. Jesus has been raised from the dead, and he joins in with two individuals walking to Emmaus, a village northwest, I believe, of Jerusalem, a few miles northwest. One of them is a man by the name of Cleopas. We're not told the name of the other. There's an ancient belief that the other was Luke. And there's some reasons why people believe that. Luke's gospel is the only one that tells this story, and he seems to have a great deal of information about the story. And there are some who think that Luke's doing here what John does in his gospel. John never speaks of himself in the first person, always in the third, the disciple whom Jesus loved or something like that. And maybe Luke is showing the same sort of reticence that John showed. I don't know if there's anything to that. But I do know that there are two men walking to Emmaus, and Christ joins with them. And they ask Christ, whom they don't recognize, well, did you hear about what happened in Jerusalem? And Jesus said, what are you talking about? And Cleopas said, about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and have crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. And besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened. Yea, and many and certain women of our company who were at the tomb early astonished us. And when they did not find his body, they came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. And certain of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. I mean, he had all the information. He knew about Christ's death. He knew about the report of the women. He knew about the report of Peter and John. He apparently had gone out there and confirmed what he had heard. The tomb was empty. And the implications of that had not sunk into him. You know, of the four major religions based on a personality, Judaism and Abraham, Buddhism and Buddha, Islam and Mohammed, Christianity and Jesus, only one of the four has an empty tomb. That's got to be explained. Cleopas goes out there and knows it all, but has not made any impression on him. Look what Christ says in verse 25. O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe. We get ideas in our head, and it doesn't matter how many scriptures we run up against that knock them down. It doesn't matter how much evidence we come across. We're going to do just about anything but give up our presuppositions and open our mind to an honest consideration of the data staring us in the face. Six times in the Gospels, Jesus tells the disciples that they had little faith. And what that phrase indicates, that they of all people should not have had it. They had all the information they needed to believe what he said, and yet they didn't believe what he said. Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. Two disciples of John come to Jesus. John's sitting in prison. And John wants to know, are you the one who was coming, or should we look for another? Even that great man John had to struggle with some doubt and perplexity. And so none of us are immune or exempt from running into situations where our belief is going to be challenged. Are we going to take Christ at his word? Christ told Mary, with God all things are possible, and he doesn't have to work a miracle to make all things possible. And what did Christ do then with Zacharias? And what did he do with the man with the demonized son who said, help thou my unbelief? I'll tell you what he did. He helped him. He cast the demon out of the man's son. 9 months later, John and Elizabeth had a baby boy. And the disciples, who were told explicitly by Christ, I'm going to be put to death, but I'm going to be raised the third day. And notice Cleopas said, here it is the third day since all these things happened. And it still hadn't hit him what's going on. Christ was raised from the dead. You know, in the book of Acts, the disciples are never accused of having little faith. Now, they are in the Gospels. I mean, in the Gospels, they've got a storm that's about to swamp the boat, sink it. They've got Peter walking on water and the storm's raging around him. They've got this and that. And they've got situations in Acts that far exceeded that. They've got James being put to death. They've got Peter being thrown in prison. They've got persecution from the religious establishment. But never once were they accused of having little faith because God helped their unbelief. And the same is true with us. When we struggle, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. You go back to the resurrection. Paul in Ephesians 1, in his prayer for the Ephesians, prayed that they would know that they have access to resurrection power. In regard to Zacharias and Elizabeth, God did with them what he did with Abraham and Sarah. He brought life out of death, out of the deadness of their procreative powers. He brought forth life. And the greatest demonstration of that, of course, was the resurrection. And then there's a final thing I'll say. We're going to struggle with belief. We have been helped in that regard. All right? Luke says, Theophilus, I want you to know the certainty of the things in which you've been instructed. And then Luke tells Theophilus, when he gets to Acts, about infallible proof. Proof that cannot be gainsaid, proof that cannot be disproven. If a proof can be disproven, it's not an infallible proof. And based on that, Theophilus had a reason for believing in the certainty, not the probability, the certainty of the things in which he had been instructed. But there's a third thing to add to all of this, and it's what Christ told a man when he said, according to your faith, be it unto you. Now, Christ is going to bless us many times, whether we believe or not. I mean, the sun's going to come up tomorrow on the atheist, and the rain's going to fall because God is gracious. But there are blessings that accrue to us in direct proportion to the faith we have. Christ starts out the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are you, blessed are, seven times, blessed are you, and then he gets to the eighth, the octave, and he says, blessed are you when you're persecuted. Now, a lot of people think you're only blessed when there's no trouble, when the trouble disappears, when the problem is cleared up, when it's solved, when it goes away. Christ says, blessed are you when you're persecuted, when the trouble comes, when the pain comes. Do you believe it's possible to be blessed in the midst of whatever problem you're dealing with right now? I suspect there are people here dealing with heartbreak, dealing with fear, dealing with anxiety, afraid of what might be coming. Do you think it's possible for you to live radiant and joyfully? Christ said we can. Do you think it's possible to have the abundant life when life is falling apart? Christ said we can. Do we believe him? There's a song we sing, Precious Memories, and there's a line in that song. I'll close with this. As I ponder, hope grows fonder. Jesus tells John's two disciples, go back and tell John to ponder. Tell him what you've seen. Tell him the miracles you've witnessed. Just tell him to think about all that. And that'll get him through. That'll help him. And his belief will be revived. And I would close with that. If we struggle at times with doubt, perplexity, if we struggle with crossing the line like Zacharias apparently did I just don't believe that can ever happen. As we ponder our hope, God enabling, we'll grow fonder. And our belief will be strong. Thank you for listening tonight. If there's anyone here that we can help in any way in your relationship with Christ, if you'll let us know, we'll do all we can as together we stand and as we sing.